Chapter 20. We're rolling. Sandrine. Anxiety about keeping the Pegasus Project under wraps for a few more weeks and keeping our source out of harm's way before, during, and after publication was causing me some restless nights. The chief worry among the other partners in the last days of June was the question of the forensics. Claudio and Danica had been calm and steady hands throughout the investigation, and anybody in the consortium who had watched them work up close or sat in on their presentations walked away confident in their technical expertise. But every one of these journalists had editors back home to answer to, and each of their publications had attorneys who were paid to be skeptical and to demand as much proof as could be obtained and to keep their clients out of court. The editors and the lawyers all wanted some serious reinforcement of the security lab's findings, and we had all agreed at our conference back in May that the best possible reinforcement was a peer review of the forensics. There was a single best possible option for the technical review. The gold standard of independent cybersecurity research facilities was Citizen Lab. The institution and its personnel were known in the field and respected around the world. So everybody on the project was pleased when Citizen Lab and its lead computer scientist, Bill Marzak, signed on to conduct the peer review. The head of Amnesty Tech, Dana Ingleton, set up the mechanics with Ron Diebert, the director of Citizen Lab in Toronto. The first stage of the two-part review was forensic analyses on a few of the iPhones in which Claudio and Danica had found evidence of compromise by Pegasus. The review would be done blind, using Citizen Lab's own forensic tools, without any knowledge of the methodology the security lab had used in its analysis. The hope was that Citizen Lab would replicate the security lab's findings. The second part of the peer review would be a more general audit of the methodology Claudio and Danica had employed. Kind of like an outside coach watching game film after the fact and grading the plays. I didn't foresee any problems, but that didn't mean I was free of worry. Any unexpected issues in the peer review could be devastating to the investigation. If Citizen Lab was unable to replicate our findings or found serious problems in our methodology, salvaging the Pegasus Project would be an uphill battle. We sent off three separate iPhone backup files to Toronto on June 24th, with the permission of the owners, Khadija Ismailova, Sabal Chpani, and Edwi Plenal, and asked for a quick turnaround. The first results came back 4 days later, which felt like a very long 4 days. Bill Marzak and his colleague John Scott Railton called to let us know what they'd found and then sent us their written report. When I opened the file, I skimmed through the short section containing the Pegasus-generated process names that Citizen Lab had recognized in each of the three new analyses and went straight to the money paragraph. "We conclude with high confidence," it read, "that all three iPhones were successfully infected with NSO Group's Pegasus spyware during the dates mentioned. Our high confidence conclusion stems from the fact that we have never seen the above process names used in a benign context, and we have only ever seen the above process names used in high confidence cases of infection with NSO Group's Pegasus spyware." I posted my synopsis of the first stage of the peer review on the secure site that each of the partners could access, along with a PDF of the report Citizen Lab had forwarded. And I anticipated the collective sigh of relief from Pegasus Project collaborators all over the world. Craig Timberg posted a comment almost immediately. "This is tremendous news," he wrote. "Well done." Miranda Petruchik from OCCRP seconded him. "This is excellent." Neither Claudio nor Danica was going to crow about this validation of their work, in part because neither of them was angling for the spotlight. The two had remained low-key, nose-to-the-grindstone craftsmen throughout our partnership. That wasn't going to change. But when Claudio got on a secure call 2 days later to be interviewed by a small subgroup of the partners, who wanted quotes from him for their opening day stories, now just 18 days away, he seemed almost buoyant. He may have even smiled a few times. Claudio was on the line for an hour and a half, patiently taking questions, prepared to explain anything from the first draft of the 80-page report he and Danica were planning to release on our publication date. Claudio had provided the draft to all the partners earlier that day. He was hearing the same questions he had fielded from some of these same reporters already, sometimes over and over. How do you know it is Pegasus and not some other spyware? But he seemed happy to answer. These process names are very unique, very peculiar. There are only a few dozen of these, and they are not legitimate iOS process names. And I can say it for a fact because I also did the exercise of downloading every single version of iOS, which was released since 2016. And I checked every single file that was released with it. And none of these actually appear on it. So we know that these processes that appear are not legitimate processes, they're malicious processes. We know that they are Pegasus processes because they are connected to the network infrastructure we've seen. He went back over the intrusive capabilities of NSO's spyware. When an iPhone is compromised, it's done in such a way that allows attackers to obtain so-called root privileges, or administration privileges, on the device, that virtually allows anything to be done on the phone. That meant anything, adding a new thought to the discussion. If somebody wanted to know how fast you were moving while driving your car, Claudio explained, all the NSO engineers had to do was write the code and slip it into the infected phone. Claudio answered questions about the dynamics of the battle between NSO and mobile phone manufacturers like Apple, which was probably still the best at playing defense. Credit where credit is due, he said of Apple. But someone that is very talented out there, motivated by the very high remuneration they get from finding these issues, is working in all possible ways to bypass and find workarounds. He reminded the reporters about the goodie bag of workaround exploits NSO could offer their Pegasus licensees. I imagine there's a good chunk they discover and develop themselves, he explained. And there's probably a good chunk to be acquired from external researchers and brokers. By the end of the interview, I couldn't help reflecting on the value of this collaboration between journalists and technical experts. Whatever wariness Claudio, Danica, Laurent, and I had had about one another in that first meeting in Berlin back in 2020 had evaporated. We had each made the others better at our jobs, and that was no small thing. Claudio and Danica's technical expertise not only provided the reporters on the project a much more nuanced understanding of the Pegasus system and NSO and the entire cyber surveillance industry, it had also opened an avenue to help them find the most emblematic and powerful personal stories. And by getting out in the field and scaring up more than 60 different phones for forensic analysis, the reporters on the Pegasus project had managed to deliver to the resident empiricists at the security lab the means to new discovery. The more attack records you see, the more you compare traces, the more clear the picture becomes, Claudio told the group that day. You start putting together all the pieces of the puzzle, and it starts becoming more obvious. So it all kind of adds up. Things started getting really real for me after that, in the first week of July, because it was my job to coordinate the massive 5-day worldwide multi-platform publication involving 17 independent newsrooms, each with its own prerogatives and its own editors and its own attorneys. We were still wrangling details of the order of the rollout of the stories 10 days before our publication date. For maximum impact and minimum blowback, the rollout had to be synchronized, and the content needed to be as uniform as possible. The general outlines of the schedule I mapped were acceptable to all. On day one, the consortium would lay out the scope and scale of the use of NSO's Pegasus spyware system. But the focus would be on journalists and human rights defenders who had been victimized. Almost all the partners planned to make the targeting of Jamal Khashoggi's family members, wife, fiancé, and one son, friends and colleagues, the lead story that first day. But not all. Direct 36 preferred to lead with the story of its own reporters being spied on with Pegasus, courtesy of the Orbán government. The Wire would headline stories about journalists being cyber-surveilled in India, including those compromised in their own newsroom. OCCRP planned to highlight the Khadija Ismailova story. The partners all agreed to hold the names of world leaders and government officials selected for targeting by NSO until day three, to make sure the more serious issues about cyber surveillance of private citizens weren't overwhelmed by dog bites man headlines about geopolitical spy games. The odds of that happening had increased immensely just a few days earlier, when the team from Le Monde had finally been able to confirm that a mobile phone number in the data was, in fact, that of sitting French President Emmanuel Macron. Le Monde had confirmed the selection of more than a dozen other key members of the Macron administration. There were a handful of other presidents and prime ministers in the data that we had been able to confirm with multiple sources and could now identify in print. The final request for a change in schedule came from The Wire in India. The original plan was to save the story of Pegasus being used to spy on Rahul Gandhi, the most serious political rival of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, until day five. Exposing the Modi government for what looked like the criminal act of surveilling a political opponent was a potentially explosive revelation in the world's largest democracy. We all wanted to give the story its own space, where it didn't have to compete for attention. But the editor at The Wire, Siddharth Varadarajan, didn't think his website could hold the story for 4 days. He was afraid Gandhi would talk to other news outlets in India as soon as the Pegasus project went live, and The Wire would lose the biggest scoop in its home territory. I sent a query to the partners about moving up the Gandhi report. "We know it's an important story for The Wire," I explained, "and that they have done important work investigating it." Everybody agreed to move Gandhi to day two, making the headline story of day five the potential targeting of people close to the Dalai Lama. The other tricky bit of coordination was making sure the partners stuck to the same language in paragraphs describing the nature of the leak and the central conclusions of the investigation. In the first case, we needed to make sure we continued to protect the personal safety of our source. In the second, we needed to make sure none of the partners overstepped the boundary lines of what our forensic evidence and our reporting revealed about NSO and its clients. The editors and lawyers of each partner could determine for themselves just how far they wanted to go. But we needed them all to know there were lines that could not be crossed, both to ensure accuracy and to meet the professional standards we all shared. A person on the list we had confirmed, for instance, we could say was selected for possible Pegasus attack by a client of NSO. You should never imply that someone was successfully targeted unless we can prove so through forensic analysis of the phone, I wrote in a fact sheet distributed to all the partners. We did, by then, feel confident in reporting the extraordinary fact that the data we had been given access to contained about 50,000 unique phone numbers. Our confidence came from the forensic work Claudio and Danica had done, in spite of limitations. It was impossible, for instance, given time constraints, the danger of exposing our investigation, or the very real possibility of putting the source in harm's way, to approach everybody we could confirm in the data and ask them to let us do the forensics on their mobile phone. But we had been able to safely run technical analyses on more than 60 phones belonging to journalists, lawyers, and human rights activists, none of whom were criminals, terrorists, or pedophiles. According to the forensic analysis by Claudio and Danica 85% of the iPhones in our data being used at the time of selection showed evidence of infection. Nearly 9 out of 10. We know that we see records of phone numbers selected by NSO clients before Pegasus infections. I explained in our fact sheet. We know infection always occurs after a selection. In quite a few cases, there is approximately 30 seconds between selection and iMessage lookups on the device. The time varies between seeing the iMessage lookups and Pegasus process on the device, but it's in the range of 5 minutes to 1 hour. Conclusion we can make is phone numbers we see were entered in a system used by NSO clients before a Pegasus attack. Laurent and the lead editor of the Pegasus project at The Guardian, Paul Lewis, got Edward Snowden on the phone the first week in July. Paul had worked on the Snowden story back in 2013, when the former U.S. government contractor revealed that the NSA was monitoring communication traffic, if not actual conversations, en masse, and had the capability of building a pattern of life profile on anybody who used a cell phone or the internet. Those revelations had real consequences, both intended and unintended. Tech companies like Apple began to put a premium on encryption of communication to ensure privacy, and marketed their ability to provide a new layer of personal security. Law enforcement agencies around the world then made pleas for a backdoor into encrypted devices, like laptops and cell phones, so they wouldn't go dark and lose their ability to track terrorists and other criminals. The tech companies rightly refused, pointing out that if they created and distributed backdoors to self-proclaimed white hats like the FBI, the black hats were sure to get them too, and could then do damage to innocent people. NSO and other private companies stepped into that breach, learning how to exploit software vulnerabilities in mobile phones, and selling to law enforcement and intelligence agencies the tools to catch the bad guys. The centerpiece of this is a leak of data from NSO Group, Paul told Snowden in their Zoom call on July 5, 2021. We have 50,000 phone numbers. Edward Snowden is not easily shocked by stories about the spread of cyber surveillance, but he seemed taken aback. He was silent for a couple of seconds while the number sank in. 50,000, he said. Wow. Yeah, more than 50,000, Paul explained. It's a completely different scale, Snowden mused. You know, the general argument that the NSA, and also these commercial companies that are trying to do the same thing, is that it's targeted, you know? It's only used against criminals. It's only used against bad people. To have 50,000 phone numbers that have been targeted just puts the lie to that kind of argument. NSO has always maintained the line. Our clients are contractually bound to only use this technology against terrorists and criminals, Paul said. What we found is that on a pretty sort of widespread basis across the world, these governments have been using a technology to spy on or target journalists, activists, lawyers, human rights defenders, academics, business people, senior religious figures, politicians up to, and including some heads of state. Sort of everyone, really. Not a major surprise, Snowden responded. But then, 50,000 people. I just kind of keep repeating that number to myself. A company like NSO really shouldn't exist. These are devices that exist in every context, on every desk, every home, all over the world, and we are dependent. We cannot work, we cannot communicate, we cannot trade, we cannot go about our lives in a normal, expected way today without using these. The only thing that the NSO Group does, their only product, is trying to discover weaknesses in these devices that we all rely on and then sell them commercially. There's no limitation. There's only Israel pinky promising that they're going to have their Ministry of Defense, or whatever, review the export license. Just 10 minutes into the call, Snowden was on a roll. The fix, as he saw it, was some kind of global regulation to bring the cyber surveillance industry to heel. Maybe the EU would be moved finally to act. NSO is not trying to save the world, he continued. They're not trying to do anybody any good. They're trying to make money, despite their public claims to the contrary. When you create the means of infection and you start passing them off to the highest bidder, as the NSO group has done and is doing and will do tomorrow, if nothing changes, you are guaranteeing that the world will be less safe tomorrow than it is today. Before he signed off, Snowden told Paul he would be happy to assist the Pegasus Project any way he could. If you guys want me to help, just announce it, Snowden said, because this is a story. Paul Lewis understood, as well as any of our partners, the potential impact of this story, as well as the potential for damage. Given the libel laws in the United Kingdom, The Guardian was likely to be among the most exposed of our media partners. Paul was mindful of one of the final key pieces of business for the Pegasus Project: composing a letter to NSO, asking for response and comment on what we intended to report. The letter was a must, legally and ethically. It offered NSO the opportunity to speak to all the key facts that the consortium would be reporting. The most difficult balancing act in this effort was a matter of timing. A few of the partners had wanted to send our request for response to NSO weeks in advance. But there were partners still reporting, and we didn't want to give NSO or its clients the chance to scuttle that work before we were ready. Laurent and I were aiming to send the letter to NSO on July 10th, which would give them 4 days to respond to specifics in our upcoming publication, and still leave another 4 days for further discussion with NSO, and for any necessary refinements or emendations of our stories before the project went live. The partners were also working on separate drafts of requests for response to be sent to all the governments that had, by pretty clear evidence, licensed and used Pegasus. The team at The Guardian took the lead in writing the first draft of the request for response. The joke around the office in London was that they had the perfect man for the job. David Pegg's first big job at The Guardian was on an investigation in 2015 into allegations that the Swiss bank HSBC helped its wealthy banking customers conceal assets and dodge taxes. As the junior member of the team, David was assigned the thankless task of composing request for response letters for more than 150 people implicated in the Swiss leaks scandal. David signed the letter himself, and what followed was an avalanche of threats from rich and powerful folks sent to The Guardian's editors and lawyers. "Do you have any idea what this fellow David Pegg is doing?" David laughs about how he had been very truly and rightly intimidated at first, but pretty quickly became desensitized to it. "I still think of it as a happy memory, strangely," David told us at one point. "My friends all think I'm weird." Anyway, David took on the job of drafting the request for response to NSO with Paul's help. The two organized the letter in 4 separate categories: individuals targeted by Pegasus, NSO's dealings with the clients who appear to have misused its spyware, conclusions that could rationally be drawn from the reporting we had done, and a catch-all of other salient facts we had turned up about NSO's business deals and its relationship with the Israeli government. Claudio and Danica, meanwhile, were finishing up a 23-page report laying out their findings for NSO to see. Titled "Technical Analysis of Forensic Traces and Network Measurements," the report included the NSO-generated domain names, process names, iCloud accounts, and specific exploits that the security lab had discovered and tied to the Pegasus system. This would also give NSO the opportunity to refute any of the specifics of the security lab's forensic analyses. Nobody on the Pegasus Project believed that NSO would respond in any meaningful or professional way. Amnesty International, the Security Lab, and Citizen Lab had sent similar pre-publication letters to NSO for various investigations going back to 2016 and received little by way of serious answers to serious questions. We, on our side, publish very detailed, peer-reviewed, evidence-based reports, Ron Diebert, the founder of Citizen Lab, told us. Their responses have been mostly ad hominem attacks, slagging us for some imagined bias that we have that's never clearly articulated. Claudio had had similar experiences with NSO and other private cyber surveillance companies, so expected more of the same, but didn't sound intimidated. "We are right on the forensics," Claudio said. "If they start challenging us, they are challenging us with empty words. They can't deny evidence." Paul Lewis didn't think NSO would answer any of the specifics we had turned up in the forensics or in the reporting, but he was convinced the letter would change the dynamics of the investigation. The minute the letter landed in Herzliya, NSO would see the Pegasus Project as an existential threat to the company. There was no upside for NSO to engage in a rational conversation about our questions, our findings, or our conclusions, journalistic or forensic. Paul expected them to attack. The letter to NSO was to go out under the signatures of Laurent and me, as agents of Forbidden Stories. But we invited back-and-forth discussions with the partners about the tone and the specific language in the letter. Paul thought it best to be aggressive, to make sure we didn't pull any punches, so nobody at NSO could say we misled them or soft-pedaled what we intended to publish. Our research suggests NSO's technology has been used by multiple governments to systematically abuse the human rights of individuals whom those governments have no justifiable basis to place under surveillance, was some of the language we agreed on. Our reporting suggests this abuse is systematic, widespread, and ongoing. We strongly believe it is in the public interest to reveal this information, which has serious implications for privacy rights of all people around the world, and the ability of people to communicate freely with one another without fear of surveillance or repression, particularly in societies where human rights abuses are likely. The letter named the specific countries our reporting had identified as licensed users and proven abusers of NSO's military-grade spyware, including Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Hungary, India, Kazakhstan, Mexico, Morocco, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, Togo, and the United Arab Emirates. We also named individuals whose phones showed clear evidence of compromise by Pegasus. We ended up delayed by a day, but Laurent and I were ready to hit the send button on the letter to NSO when the sun came up in Paris on Sunday morning, July 11th, 2021. Amnesty International had decided to take some extra precautions in Berlin just before we sent the letter and alerted NSO of the investigation and the imminent publication date. The bosses at Amnesty were a little concerned about Claudio and Danica, the two cyber researchers, soon to be spotlighted as the team that caught NSO and its client states red-handed, were ambivalent about the stepped-up security regimen. Claudio, for one, didn't think there was much danger that they would be hacked by NSO spyware. He was careful to keep his work separate from his private life, didn't have a personal cell phone number, and rarely used social media other than Twitter, and then only under his nom de plume. "I don't have a very digitally rich life," he joked. On top of that, he told Laurent and me later, "I would hope it would be a dissuading factor for some, knowing that, you know, we are the ones equipped to catch them in the first place." Danica was no more worried than Claudio about being hacked, but he did have his own safety concerns, which seemed understandable, for a man who had memories of being rousted from bed in the middle of the night by an angry posse of Irish lawmen. He wasn't as worried about the technical capabilities of NSO as he was about the nasty proclivities of some of NSO's clients, who were to be informed, any day, of the Pegasus Project and of the security lab's role in it. These were some brutal regimes who had proven willing to commit ugly acts of intimidation and violence without fear of consequence, on their own soil and off of it. The Kingdom of Morocco had been holding Omar Radi in prison, often in solitary confinement, for more than a year, and he was only now getting his day in court. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia had ordered the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, a man who had done nothing more than criticize him. Danica had also been reading news reports about the case of Mohamed Mirzali, a 27-year-old Azeri blogger who had fled Baku and settled in Nantes, France, 5,000 kilometers away. Mohamed thought he would be safe enough in France to continue to post messages critical of President Aliyev's financial corruption and the bloody war in Armenia on his YouTube channel, Made in Azerbaijan. But the distance had not put Mohamed or his family beyond the reach of Azerbaijan. His parents also fled to France after his father and brother-in-law were threatened and encouraged to stifle Mohamed. His sister had suffered the indignation of having an illegal recording of one of her intimate moments circulated online, a shrill echo of the blackmail attempt on Khadija Ismailova. Mohamed himself was shot at while sitting in a parked car in October 2020. And in March 2021, he was attacked in Nantes and stabbed 10 to 14 times. The medical reports released to the public were uncertain. Aliyev has publicly stated that there is not enough evidence for him to deign to respond to what he calls groundless and biased accusations that his government was responsible for the attacks on Mohamed. Three of the four men charged with the crime a year later, however, were Azeri nationals. Mohamed Mirzali survived after a six-hour surgery, only to receive a text a week later. "This is the last warning," it read. "We can kill you without any problem. You've seen that we're not afraid of anyone. We'll have you killed with a bullet to the head fired by a sniper." The threats had continued into June, according to the latest reporting, and Danica suspected they were probably ongoing. So when Amnesty International offered to relocate Claudio and Danica from their homes to undisclosed safe houses for the week leading up to publication, both of them accepted. The attacks on the Azeri dissident were in Danica's head. "He's writing satire about the Aliyev government, and the government is going to try to kill him, twice, in France," Danica says. "If the Azerbaijanis know that the Pegasus Project is going to come out, are they going to do anything to try to stop us? And it's not just Azerbaijan." Laurent and I hit the send button on the letter to NSO a little after 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, July 11th, 2021. "As fair and responsible journalists, we would like to invite you to comment on the above information and let us know if you dispute any of it," read the conclusion of the 10-page letter, which was accompanied by 23 pages of technical notes authored by Claudio and Danica. "Please respond no later than Wednesday, July 14th, 2021 at 6 p.m. French time. Any substantive comment will be fairly reflected in any coverage. Please note that we do not accept generalized assertions of inaccuracy as substantive." The moment was actually a bit disorienting. It feels a bit like being at the top of a hill in a car and removing the handbrake. Paul Lewis texted us that morning. We're rolling. Claudio and Danica were in their office that Sunday night, after dark, when a security lab server suddenly went offline. The server had been running every day for 2 years, 24 hours a day, and it had never crashed. And now, The day the letter goes out to NSO, boom, an unexplained hardware failure. Claudio flashed back to some slides he had seen years earlier from a report the U.S. intelligence services had published. They described an attack on servers that could cause immediate failure on the network card. This felt like that kind of attack. Danica was thinking the same thing. Oh, shit. Maybe somebody got into the offices and cut a cable. Maybe somebody actually stole the server. Danica raced over to see if the server was still there. That was a very tense evening at the security lab in Berlin, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. Neither Claudio nor Danica believed NSO or anybody else could breach their system or steal the Pegasus-related data they had accumulated. But it sure felt like someone was trying to sabotage the project. Danica found himself thinking a very unexpected thought while he checked the server and then the logs. Something happens to me, okay. But I want to make sure the Pegasus project succeeds.